All right, we'll call the Committee on Agricultural Economies and Veterans Affairs Finance to order. And Representative Brown moves the minutes of March 31st. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are adopted. Housekeeping things, welcome everyone to the committee meeting. Turn your cell phones off. If they ring, it's a dollar to our coffee jar, and if you answer it, it's $5. So we got that rule taken care of. And by the way, the coffee pot is over there for everyone. This is the Ag and Veterans Committee, and the coffee pot is always on. So if you didn't get your morning coffee, go help yourself. We have three bills today. I don't know how long they will take. I think the first one will go pretty quick. The second one should medium, and the last one is noxious weeds, and I'm not sure what the discussion is left to have there, but I know we have a lot of interested parties on that one, too. So, Representative Otremba, if you'd come on down, and we'll also have Dr. Mulgard come to the table. And I will, I'm going to move House File 1447 to be recommended to pass. And Representative Otremba moves House File 1447, recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Higher Education and Workforce Development Finance, Representative Rukavina's committee. And Representative Otremba also moves the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape that she needs it. You should have that in your folder. So any questions, the A1, just to get her in the shape. Seeing none, all those in favor of the A1 amendment say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Amendments adopted. Representative Otremba and Doctor, welcome to your bill.
Thank you, committee. And as Representative Dunkey said, this is Assistant Dean Mulgard, and she's going to take over now.
All right, very good. Talk about the bill and why it's here and what the need is.
Thank you, and thank you for allowing me the time to discuss this important proposal. Dean Trevor Ames has talked to some of you about this before, and he sends his regrets. He's out of the country today. So I'm the Associate Dean for Academic and Student Affairs, and as such, I work with our DVM educational program and our students and faculty on a daily basis. We really appreciate the support of this legislative bill on behalf of our college and of our students. We wish our students could be here, or at least a few representatives, but they're very busy in classes right now, so they were not able to get away. So I'll be spending about 10 minutes talking about the need for food animal veterinarians, especially in underserved areas, and also mentioning some new urgency to the need for this sort of loan forgiveness program in Minnesota is that some of our neighboring states are already adopting similar programs that could lure our graduates away from Minnesota after we've invested so much in them. So you have in your folders a PowerPoint presentation in maroon and gold that I will be following here today. On the second slide in that presentation, you'll see that some numbers that illustrate how important agriculture is to Minnesota's economy, which is, I'm sure, not news to you anyway. We are number one in turkeys, swine. We are also leaders in swine and dairy. And agriculture is an important economic engine for the state, and veterinarians are an important driver of that economic engine. It's our goal to educate veterinarians to meet the needs of society in protecting the health of animals and people. The next slide in the set illustrates the changing role of veterinarians in society today. Veterinarians very much bridge the of people and animals. We are not only committed to protecting the health of our state's animals, but also people through public health, including food safety, food supply. So the first step in doing all that is educating the appropriate workforce for that. And as you can see, there's a declining veterinary workforce in food animal veterinary medicine, and this is a national trend as well as a state trend. Food animal veterinarians are valued and respected community members, and they are very committed to their and passionate about their field. They're vital in supporting agribusiness enterprises. But despite the fact that they have challenging and rewarding careers, we have the talent that they are often lured away from food animal veterinary medicine, especially in underserved areas, to more metropolitan areas and small animal practices where they can make more income. And that's one of the things I'm going to be talking about today, is the challenge that they face with high debt loads from veterinary school and then lower incomes than their small animal colleagues. Over the past 10 years, the number of food animal veterinary graduates has declined by about 50%. We've been doing a lot to combat that in Minnesota at the University of Minnesota, but we need this important economic part to help the efforts that we've already begun. There's a copy also in your folder of an AVMA article that illustrates the need for food animal veterinarians nationally. In addition, in your handout are two articles, or a map and a one-page handout that show the distribution of veterinarians by county in Minnesota. And you can see that there are a number of counties that are very underserved by food animal veterinarians, and some don't have a veterinarian at all. And this threatens not only the animal health in that area and in the state, but also the agricultural economy. One thing that people don't always think of when they think of food animal veterinary medicine is public health. Public health is a very important role of a food animal veterinarian, or veterinarians in general, but especially food animal veterinarians, as they respond to foodborne disease, disease spread from people, from animals to people, zoonotic disease, and disaster preparedness is an important role that they play. This is especially important because of the national shortage of public health veterinarians. In the USDA and also in the U.S. Public Health Services and Armed Forces. So what we've done to combat that is we have partnered with the School of Public Health at the University of Minnesota to create a dual degree, DVM, MPH, Masters of Public Health program. And in fact, our program is larger than all of the other programs in the United States combined. We produce more MPH graduates from Minnesota than all of the other DVM MPH programs combined. Educational costs are a big part of this. They're a challenge. We have tried to increase the food animal veterinarian supply by increasing our class size from 80 to 90. So we've taken 10 more students and focused that on students who are food animal or public health. But we can't combat the fact that they're going to end up with high debt loads and, again, lower salaries than their small animal counterparts. So that's partly why this legislation is so important, so that we can not only attract students to food animal veterinary medicine, but attract them to underserved areas and then keep them in those underserved areas. One of the things that we've done to recruit food animal veterinary students is called a VetFast program. There's a brochure in your handout or in your folder. VetFast stands for Veterinary Food Animal Scholars Track, and it's an early admission, early decision program for students with a strong commitment to food animal veterinary medicine. What we do is we recruit them towards the end of high school and then guarantee them admission after their first year of undergraduate in the College of Ag at the University of Minnesota. And by doing this, we can nurture people who have this interest and commit them to that field early on. It's been a very successful program. It's been a growing program. One of my concerns, though, is that we're going to lose those grads to other states or lose them, not be able to attract them to the areas of greatest need within our state. There's a slide in your handout that shows the demand of small animal veterinarians growing and the supply being stagnant. The Bureau of Labor Statistics ranks veterinary medicine as ninth in the list of 30 fastest growing occupations. And although this is looking predominantly at small animal veterinarians, you can see how this would have an impact on food animal veterinary medicine, because when the demand is very great in small animal, the salaries keep going up and we lose people who might have had an interest in food animal veterinary medicine, might be from a rural area, to small animal practice. So again, the need for this legislation. In Minnesota, 80% of the practicing veterinarians were educated at the University of Minnesota. And last year we had 1,100 or so applicants for 90 spots. So it's extremely competitive. It's not a matter of not having a very large applicant pool. But it is continually a challenge to attract people into the food animal veterinary career and to keep them there. One of the things that we do to, in addition to the admissions program that I just mentioned, is we have a tracking system at the University of Minnesota that allows our students to specialize. And so we have two tracks, mixed animal track and food animal track, that prepare food animal veterinarians specifically for that career. And we have a very large number of experiential rotations, hands-on rotations, where they can get the kind of skills that they need. So we're confident that what we're doing to prepare them is already in good shape. There was a large study looking at the manpower issue in food animal veterinary medicine, and the recommendations were that we need to recruit, mentor, provide incentives, and prepare the students for this career. We feel confident that we're doing a lot of what we need to be doing for recruiting and mentoring, and I've talked a little bit about that a moment ago. But one of the pieces, though, that is missing are the incentives. We don't have very many scholarships available to recruit students into food animal medicine, and we don't have the loan forgiveness program in this state to incentivize them. So some novel approaches that we've taken to try to address this at our college are the admissions program with the VetFast program I just mentioned. One of the other things that's unique about our admissions process is that, unlike most other veterinary colleges, we don't just look at academics and experience. We look at, we do a behavior-based interview to look for students who have attributes for success and leadership in the profession. So that's one of the things that Minnesota is known for nationally. The DVM MPH program I already discussed, that trains more veterinary public health professionals than all of the other programs combined. And again, the hands-on experience that we're able to provide for them. We have some unique educational facilities at Minnesota that are really the envy of other veterinary schools around the country to train food animal veterinarians. Partly this is because of our private-public partnership. So for example, we work with Davis Family Farms in New Sweden, Minnesota. The Davisco Dairy is a dairy where students can go and live and work for 2 weeks at a time and get the kinds of real-world experience that they need to be good practitioners when they're out. And finally, an accredited high-quality veterinary diagnostic lab is a crucial part of the training that we have for these food animal veterinary medicine students. So it's our responsibility to educate and prepare them to meet the needs of society. But we come before this legislature to encourage you to support us in assisting the veterinary graduates in providing debt forgiveness. Their debt when they graduate from school far exceeds their starting salary, and their starting salaries are lower than the other fields that they can go into within veterinary medicine. It's our goal to have every county in the state have adequate food animal veterinary support, and we're doing our best to recruit and train those students. 406 veterinarians for nearly 9 million animals is not enough to properly care for the growing needs of our state in both protection of human and animal health as well as agribusiness. So with the, again, with the loan forgiveness programs in the neighboring states, this has become an especial concern for us in recent times. So I would like to thank you for giving me the time to talk about this. I'm very happy to answer any questions, and a special thanks to Representative Atrenda.
And Dr. Mulgaard, I have a question. I can't read the handout. It's too small here.
Okay.
But I did meet with my vets out in, I think it was up in Spicer. I met at a veterinarian office, and Minnesota Veterinarians Association was there. We talked about the need for large animal vets, but I can't, if you could amplify a little bit. I know in my area we have plenty, but what parts of the, where in the state are we seeing those holes and gaps, and And is there reasons why it's in some parts of the state and not the others?
Yeah, if you look in your folder, the demographic map that shows the distribution of veterinarians is this, and then a list by county is here. So then you can see that the counties with zero, with not enough veterinarians or no veterinarians are in the in this far right column, the ones with an X, Y, or Z in them. So, Aiken, Beltrami, Big Stone, Chippewa, Cook, Crow Wing, Kitson, Kuching, Lockheed Charles, Lake, etc., are some of the counties that are underrepresented.
Well, typically they tend to be probably our more sparsely populated,
mm-hmm.
human-populated counties,
right.
But they still have animal populations.
Sure.
Okay. Representative Magnus.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Mulgard, great presentation. I really appreciate you putting this together. It gives us, it certainly gives us a better understanding of where we're at. But I'm interested in a couple of the slides. You indicate in, I think, the fourth one in that a lot of veterinarians now are getting up in age, and I'm wondering if you look at the breakdown of this, how many of the of those folks getting up, and I live in Southwest Minnesota, so certainly it's a concern to me.
Mm-hmm.
How many of those folks are switching even from basing their most of their business or practice on large animal or food animal veterinarians to small animals? Are quite a few of those folks doing that as they get wiser, get kicked a little less times by big steers? So
it isn't uncommon for veterinarians as they progress in their career to switch over to working more with small animals, but perhaps not to give up on the food animal practice entirely, but maybe switch to a more mixed sort of practice. So that is one of the issues, is not only getting people started off on the right foot, but keeping them in that part of the profession.
So Mr. Chairman and Dr. Mulgard, are those folks open to more mentoring programs, these kind of things, to get new graduates to come out and work with them and raffle those years on?
Dr. Mulgard.
It's an important piece of it. And so one of the things we've done with our VetFast admissions program is that we found mentors for these students. To get them very committed to the profession early on. And so even though we might be recruiting them when they're seniors in high school, we have a pretty good idea that by the end of that next year whether or not they're really committed to food animal or if they're really wanting to go to vet school and know that they're supposed to say they like food animals. So we have a really strong sense by then if they're really committed to veterinary medicine. And a lot of it is that mentoring with a positive role model in the profession who really is passionate about what they do.
Well, Mr. Chairman, one final point for me. I was really shocked to see the cost.
Yeah.
Holy cow, $200,000+ to get a DMV degree.
Mm-hmm.
I don't wonder why we got so many PhDs running around this place. Now, I just can't believe you're looking at $210,000 for a doctor of veterinary medicine versus looks like an average of about $81,000 for a PhD. This is a serious, serious problem to me. I don't know how in the world, even though you had, I see you have 1,100 applicants for these few spots. I don't know how you're going to continue to get people to go into this with that kind of money out there.
It's an interesting question, and it's true nationwide. We're not entirely unique in Minnesota. The health professions are very expensive professions to educate for. And so if we include on that slide, and it might be helpful for future reference, what it costs to educate a dentist, a nurse, a doctor, I think you'd be much more in line with that. It's just a very expensive educational program, in part because of the hands-on training required and the small student-to-instructor ratios that we need for that kind of training, especially once they reach that fourth clinical year. We have small groups of students working with a clinician, with animals, doing hands-on kinds of things, unlike an undergraduate program where you can have a sage on the stage in front of 500 students. That's a cheaper way to teach, but it doesn't work when we're talking about learning health care.
Representative Faust.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two quick questions. First, you mentioned this a little bit, and I'm sorry I stepped out if you did cover this more specifically, but how much difference is there in the starting wages of a veterinarian that starts with small animals mm-hmm. compared to large animals?
It's about $10,000 difference that first year, give or take. Well, and it depends which figures you're looking at, because we collect different figures from different sources, but it's about, about a $58,000 starting salary for a food animal veterinarian and about a $68,000 starting salary for a small animal veterinarian with the same debt load.
Why is there so much difference in that?
Dr. Mulgar.
To some extent, it is because of the economic realities of a small animal practice. That the patients that a small animal veterinarian is caring for are often considered by their owners as family members, free family members, that they can use discretionary income to provide whatever health care they need or want for them. Whereas in food animal veterinary medicine, it's very much about economics. And if this isn't economically a wise decision to make, it's not in that producer's best interest to do that for that individual animal the way, somebody might be willing to spend $3,000 for a total hip for their dog. They're not going to be able to do things like that for a food-producing animal.
That follows.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Magnus mentioned the cost that veterinarians are leaving college with. Can you give me an idea how much that's increased in the last 6 years?
Dr. Mulgard.
That's a very good question, and I can't give you a firm number, an accurate firm number off the top of my head, but tuition has been going up about 6 or 7% a year over the last several years. And again, in conversations with my colleagues nationally, that's not really outside of normal. The cost of doing business.
Over them false.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in the last 10 years, it's approximately doubled. I mean, the rule of 72 would say that it's close to doubled in the last 10 years.
Dr. Mulligard.
I wouldn't want to say that without getting you real numbers, but it's definitely, when I went to school.
When was that?
I graduated in 91, so I started in 87.
What was the cost then?
I graduated with $18,000 worth of debt, not $100,000. So part of that might have been luck that my family helped out a little bit, and partly that things were a lot less expensive back then.
Right. Thank you very much.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I want to thank the doctor, too, for this great presentation. And I recall my earlier days before head gates and squeeze chutes, my great vet coming out, getting a rope around a uncooperative cow and trying to work on them. They do one great job, these large animal vets. But the number that sticks out in my mind on the second page, the interest seems to be there are 1,100 applications for 90 spots.
Yeah.
So what about the possibility of expanding the program?
We would love to expand the program. We expanded from 80 to 90 five, 6 years ago, and we've not been able to expand anymore because of our classroom size. We just are physically limited by being able to fit any more people into the lecture room and the lab. So there have been some national efforts to look at national funding for veterinary workforce expansion for colleges around the country to look at bricks and mortar kinds of projects because of that. And Minnesota is an example of a place that could benefit from something like that, because we do believe that the data shows us that the workforce needs are greater than we're able to contribute to.
Okay, any other questions or discussion? We thank you for coming, and Representative Otremba, I think this bill is important. I know that when we go to some of the national conferences, there's been a lot of talk from the other states, our Council of State Governments and others. I chair an Ag Committee, and I know the discussions have been in that committee and other places. So it's not, you're right, it's not just a Minnesota issue. It's all over the country, and we're hoping we can, in the next year or two, come up with some solutions to this, or we will face kind of a vet crisis out there in certain areas of the state. So just like we are with nurses and doctors and other things too, but people often forget the agriculture end of it out across there. So we appreciate that. Representative Tremba renews her motion that House File 1447, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Higher Education, Workforce Development, Finance. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Bill is passed. Thank you, Representative Tremba. Thank you, Dr. Malgard. Now I'm going to go up to the front and ask Representative Hamilton to
chair.
Representative Junkie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move House File 47 before the committee for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill next week. And I see the first thing you're doing is throwing name tags around on the floor there. Whose was it? Oh, wasn't mine. Then it's all right. Then I would move, Mr. Chair, to get the bill in the shape I want, the DE2 amendment.
Representative Junkie moves the DE2 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion fails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm joined at the table. I'll ask him to testify later. City Councilman Jim Dockin drove down today to help out with some testimony. And certainly if there's anyone else in the room that wants to testify once we're done with this presentation, I'd welcome them up also. What the DE2 amendment did is basically emulate language that is in our bonding bill this year for a mental health facility for veterans. And I don't often say this, but I think this is probably one of the most important pieces of legislation that this committee or this body will talk about this year as it moves forward. This process started probably 5 or 6 years ago in earnest, recognizing a need for mental health care for geriatric veterans. That is, veterans that may have needs beyond what our normal nursing homes, who might take veterans vouchers, can handle, beyond what our veterans homes in this state. We have veterans homes in Silver Bay, Laverne, Fergus Falls, Hastings, and Minneapolis. This facility was envisioned by them, the Veterans Home Board, as a facility that would take patients that couldn't go there because of severe mental health illness and still a need for care and utilizing the veterans' benefits. So the process was put in place to develop a strategy to care for these veterans, not only in Minnesota, but perhaps regionally in the upper Midwest. And as we have progressed, a number of things happened. Obviously, we got involved in a conflict overseas, which has added, I think, to the interest in this and, frankly, to the seriousness of this. I look at some of these. I've got a thick booklet here, and I keep articles. VA to test all combat vets for brain injury. Rural areas unprepared for brain-injured vets. Injured without treatment. Iraq war veteran and TBI and PTSD fall through the cracks at the VA. In an article here that was printed on the St. Cloud Times, how many soldiers will be diagnosed with PTSD is hard to say, the doctor said. It's something mental health professionals won't know for years. Home from Iraq, National Guard members will face mental health hurdles. The 21st century vision for care of veterans, looking beyond the Minneapolis home and other standard care homes. and on and on and on. I've got a whole folder full of these. But what we did then as a body, we see this coming. Number one, we know we have geriatric folks we got to take care of who were World War II and Korean War folks. We also know we have a large flush of Vietnam veterans that are reaching retirement age and will continue to have complications due to their service back in the 1960s and 70s that we continue and should and will have to address. And we know for a fact that the Iraq and Afghan conflict, the signature injury of that war is TBI, traumatic brain injury. And the reason we know it, members, is we did participate as a legislative body, and we asked for a study, and some of you were here when we presented that study a couple years ago. We asked what the needs were going to be from these folks, and we learned that TBI is the biggest and the fastest growing injury that we're going to be addressing, and we need to be prepared for it. Again, why is that? For those that weren't involved, what we're seeing is in Iraq, where my son is now, actually he's home on leave for a couple days, but he'll be heading back. But in Iraq, what happens is we're saving lives better than we've ever done, ever, in any conflict. If a soldier is wounded in the field, within an hour they are at a major hospital and being treated. We have body armor. We have good headgear. We have all sorts of tools that are saving lives, unlike Vietnam and previous conflicts. The problem is the headgear is so good and holds so tight that when a repercussion goes off near a veteran or near a soldier, the brain tends to get rattled in there. And as we bring those folks back home, even though we test for it and look for it, we don't know when that traumatic brain injury is going to show up. It could be tomorrow, it could be next month, it could be 5 or 10 years from now. Playing a touch football game and hitting your head with your kids on the ground, and all of a sudden you're into a TBI incident. So it's one of those things like PTSD that tends to be there, and we're looking for ways to better identify and treat. But at this point, we're still in kind of an infancy stage of that. Along with our work to understand the TBI, we've also, this legislature has paid for a pre-design for this building already too. So we have an investment in this facility as we move ahead. What is the latest vision of that facility, and what are we looking at? Well, again, as we talk about the amendment that just went on, I think what you're going to see here is something that's extremely unique and will probably become a model not only for Minnesota but maybe nationally as we move forward. Again, the commissioner who we've been working with on this, and by the way, this facility was recommended by the commissioner's office as a priority project in the past too. It was on their list of recommended projects. And other than Minneapolis 17 last year and this project, we're the only two that haven't been completed yet. So this is something that's gone through the vetting process with the old Homes Board and now the current commissioner's office, and has been established as a priority need. But what we're looking at is basically a facility that will include but not be limited to geriatric care for mental health veterans with severe behavioral problems. That's what we talked about, those patients that can't go anywhere else. Inpatient treatment, including long-term and domiciliary care for veterans with traumatic brain injury. Inpatient treatment services, including long-term and domiciliary care for veterans with PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. Inpatient treatment for veterans with a dual diagnosis of mental illness and chemical dependency. Again, we've heard about this. It's very prevalent in some of our populations, where you're not only do you have a mental illness problem, but you're also chemically dependent a patient, and it becomes even a more difficult thing to handle. But we do have folks at some of our regional treatment centers, including in Candiac County, that have worked on that in the past, as well as programs like Project Turnabout and others in our state that are looking at that exact diagnostic treatment. long-term and domiciliary care for any veteran and standard long-term care. We do envision there will be some standard care beds in there, albeit that's not the main focus, but it will be there. We also ask that that there be partnerships formed. We ask the commissioner to look for public-private partnerships. For example, on traumatic brain injury, I've been approached by Lutheran Social Services, who is extremely interesting in partnering with the state to actually construct and staff a TBI treatment and research facility, and could become a part of this. We have talked to Project Turnabout, who is interested in helping staff and participate in a dual diagnostic type of regime at the home. And so it's unique in that way that we're looking for the public-private partnerships, as well as pursuing other federal dollars and state dollars beyond what a veteran's voucher may treat. And that's one of the problems we have, too, as we discover trying to get services out there. Veteran's vouchers don't always cover some of the care that's needed. So, again, I'm going to wrap up here as quickly as I can. I want to tell you, again, some of the history. This started way before I was chair of the committee, and I think that's an important thing to understand. But it also involved a central location in Candiota County because of our mental health facilities and staff. We had a regional treatment center and still do out there, and so we have a lot of mental health professionals there. We have the regional hospital. We have the regional Woodland Center's mental health facility in Wilmer. And so for all Southwest Minnesota and beyond, we're basically the mental health care center in that part of the state. We have a lot of trained staff, doctors, nurses, and support staff who would readily move in and fill these state jobs within that that facility. And that was one of the reasons that the Veterans Home Board originally looked at Candiota County was for that trained work staff that's out there, and we don't have a need to do a lot of recruiting, we hope, to fill those specific jobs. Also specifically, where this differs, in the bonding bill, you see bonding money. The federal government pays for 65% of these construction of these facilities, so that's a good deal. But we have to have the other 35% be non-state resources. In the bonding bill, we asked for $5 million from the state and about $4 million from the local government as the local share to match those federal funds. I feel so strongly about this, and I think we should, as a group that works with veterans, that we're going to try and make sure if something crashes in that bonding bill and it doesn't become law in there, that we've got a backup in our bill. And what we've asked in here is not do bonding, but rather do 100% local share on the construction. And I've talked to the county and cities out there, and they're willing to utilize their bonding authority. Think about when we built the Department of Ag building. It's a similar thing. The City of St. Paul Port Authority built that for the state, and we didn't then realize it as our bonding debt, and we are now occupying that building and utilizing it and paying rent to the Port Authority. So with a similar situation, we could go ahead with this without a bonding bill component and still be successful and get moving on this. And I think time is of the essence. I'm disappointed that this wasn't done last year, or we probably would have had federal stimulus dollars coming today to get that going, because the homes that were approved by the states on the top of that federal list were basically funded through stimulus dollars. We missed the boat on that, members, but I don't want to miss the next ship that's sailing. We're already on the federal list, and we've gone through that process. You sit on the federal list federally until the state gives approval, and then you move up to a priority funding project, and they look at it in their next rounds of funding. So by getting this done this year, we hope we can be included in this round of funding this year, but it may even be next year before we get that funding from the feds. And that's why it's so critical that we get this going. We can't wait any longer to treat these veterans and understand our responsibilities to these group of people that are coming back. And again, I'm committed, and I know the folks that are working on this are committed, and the department, to see that this Minnesota model perhaps becomes a national model, similar to a lot of our integration programs, our Beyond the Yellow Ribbon, those things. We do a pretty good job in this state figuring things out. And I think this bill will do exactly that as we move forward also. So I'm going to stop there. I'll certainly answer any questions, but I guess I'd ask Councilman Dockin here to say a few words and let you know that there's support out there, and he's been working long and hard on this also.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed, please.
Thank you. My name is Jim Dockin. I live at 615 Southeast 3rd Street in Wilmer. As Chairman Junkie indicated, I am a member of the Wilmer City Council, have been for 10 years. I'm a 20-year member of, retired member of the United States Air Force. I'm very active within the Disabled American Veterans and the American Legion. We do have a number of veterans that were kind enough to come in on the band this morning. We have our County Veteran Service Officer, Tricia Hagedorn, that got this set up for us, and we appreciate that.
You can wave.
Hi. we have members, Legion members, VFW members, and DAV members from Wilmer, from Spicer, from New London, from Litchfield, and from Eden Valley. I don't think I forgot anybody. Didn't realize he would be here, but our department commander, Dean Ashman, is here from the Disabled American Veterans, and it's nice to see the other veterans that are here also. We did have a meeting yesterday Mr. Rehnquist is also in the audience, and Mrs. Spaulding from our Economic Development Commission. We did meet yesterday in the City Administrator's Conference Room at Wilmer City Hall, and we did have a good discussion. Some things were new, had not been revealed before. I did take the current bill off of the website last night at about 8 o'clock. And we did discuss this in the van coming down, and I think that the position of the 13 veterans is that we still need some time to study this. We've only had a couple of meetings recently. We have a meeting scheduled for April the 15th at the American Legion Post in Litchfield. We're hoping to have a good turnout there. We will have the copy then of the bill as of what is being proposed to you today. And we would respectfully ask that we be given some time to study this bill, and I can assure you that we will have a position as veterans. We take our role in the veteran community very seriously. We believe that we are the land of the free and the home of the brave because of the more than 25.5 million veterans that have served our country, 402,000 who live in the state of Minnesota, 141,000 are Vietnam-era vets. That's the war that I was a part of. We have 45,000 World War II vets and about 70,000 Korean War vets. So Minnesota is fortunate to have 8% of its population as veterans. And when you consider there are 25.5 million, Minnesota has a large percentage of veterans for only having 5 million people. So we would look forward to coming back to the committee again and presenting to you the feelings, the consensus of the veteran community. And any questions that you might have right now, I'd be happy to answer.
Any questions from the committee?
And Mr. Chair, I would just add too that, and I didn't say this, we have about 5 or 6 requests sitting in our committee now for veterans' homes across the state that people have requested and that we're looking at and we have been discussing. We've also got a study that's due back, we hope, about May 1st through the department that will explain some of the needs for homes and care around the state. And we will utilize that, and we will have hearings on all those bills before we adjourn this session so we can prepare the bonding committee for the next round and the larger bonding bill coming and any tours and other things that may need to be accomplished this summer. So we have not let those drop to the wayside. We think they're all important to hear and do too. But again, I want to stress that this is not a Fergus Falls or Laverne. This is something that enhances and complements all of those homes around the state and, frankly, around the region where this care is not available even in a multi-state region as determined by the Veterans Home Board when they originally put this forward.
Thank you, Representative Junkie. Representative Doty has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Junkie, thank you for all your work on this very important issue, as you explained very well.
I understand, I think, the funding to get this moving rapidly, and I think it's a very good idea. Can you talk just a little bit about what ongoing costs we would be incurring by this?
Mr. Chair and Representative Doty, first of all, we don't believe there'll be any cost for this biennium or the next because we'd be in the building process. So three bienniums out when we would start funding this. Basically, we pay for in the state about 57% of the operation costs in a facility like this. About 20% comes from veterans vouchers, and the balance comes in from private pay insurance and personal funds of people that are there. That's true for all our homes. So, and the operating costs will be similar to a Laverne, Fergus Falls type facility as far as dollars go. But again, we argue, and we would continue to argue, that this will save money in the long run to the state because, again, realize these mental health issues don't go away. If we're not treating them and utilizing, frankly, the veterans vouchers and other things federally, so again, we're paying a little over 50% of the cost of this facility, 50% is other funds. If we're not doing it, someone's treating these folks, or they're ending up in emergency rooms or jails or wherever it is. I mean, this is such a serious issue. Representative Rick Avina, I forgot to mention this, but I told him I was going to do this morning, because I think this brings the seriousness of the issue home. Representative Rick Avina, my roommate and chair of the Higher Ed Committee, has a piece of legislation that we may still see yet in our omnibus bill, but it's over in Military Affairs right now in Phyllis Kahn's committee. He had a returned Iraq soldier drive into an iron ore pit and blow his brains out a few months ago. And frankly, members, enough is enough. We have to start understanding and treating this. And on behalf of that soldier's parents, he's got a bill in that we're going to require screening of our returning, we hope, of our returning National Guard troops who we have control over in this state at 30, 60, 90, 6 month, and 1 year intervals. Because again, these things don't always show up right away. And we're doing our absolute best to try and identify these problems, get them into a facility like this for 3 or 4 months or a year if need be, and then hopefully return them back to their community as fully functioning members of that community and able to be with their families and friends. So we're seeing more and more of this. It's in our own backyard, and frankly, it's time to move ahead as a state and get this taken care of.
Representative Doty, follow-up?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think, members, that that was an excellent point to make here as we explain this to people that don't have the information that we get in this committee. This will actually be saving the state money down the road. That's a very important point to make. Besides the fact that we owe these people for their sacrifices, we also owe the taxpayers that explanation, I think.
Very nice. Any other questions from the committee? Representative Junkie, any final words?
I just ask if anyone else wants to say anything, we welcome anyone to the table.
Oh, any other testifiers?
Our CVSO. And we always like seeing CVSOs here. We talk a lot about you folks as we put budgets together and other things. So here, we'll get you a chair.
Okay.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed, please.
My name is Tricia Appledorn. I'm a Candiwai County Veteran Service Officer. Thank you for having me. Mr. Dawkin is speaking on behalf of a small group of veterans that he works with. I see veterans on a daily basis come into my office, not only from the Iraqi era, but Vietnam. December 24th of 2008, a veteran from the Vietnam era committed suicide. This is an ongoing problem, not just with the Iraqi vets, but with the Vietnam vets. I see World War II vets that come into my office and sit down and start crying. This is an ongoing thing with veterans in my area. I'm a little nervous, so just excuse me.
Okay.
Mental health needs to be addressed. We have lost so many veterans, not only during a wartime period, but when they come home. Iraqi vets suffer from traumatic brain injury, which leads to chemical dependency, along with gambling problems. The Central Minnesota is known to take care of mental health issues. We are the ideal facility to have this kind of veterans home built and be able to take care of the veterans. So on behalf of Handuai County and the people and the veterans that I work with, I think this is a great project that needs to be addressed.
Thank you for what you do. Thank you for your testimony. I know it's not always easy. Any other questions or comments from the committee? Councilman Dockin, I want to thank you for your testimony, and more so thank you for your service. Just a friendly reminder to our veterans from the Vietnam era. Is it June 13, Representative Junkie, for Representative Magnus, as far as the welcome home? Right, June 13. So thank you for your service to our country. My family thanks you as well. On that, Representative Junkie renews his motion to have House File 47 be held over for possible inclusion as amended.
Thank you.
Representative Junkie, House File 1367.
All right. And I'll ask who's ever going to help out with this to mosey on down, too. I know we have some people in the audience. Members, House File 1367 is a noxious weed bill. And I will briefly describe my overview of it. Obviously, there's way more detail in here than that, and you can certainly ask questions on any area you want. But basically, if you remember, a few years ago, we had a big dust-up between counties and inspectors and others in the department on who was going to do what and how do we take care of the noxious weed situation and who's responsible, et cetera. So we sent away a task force to work on this. And frankly, the people sitting next to me here and in the audience were part of that task force, came back with this as a work product. And basically, it really doesn't change in a large way the way the noxious weed law is implemented or carried out, which is, for those of you who aren't familiar, the township or the city, the local unit of government, is responsible for inspecting noxious weeds or answering complaints on noxious weeds or carrying out the Minnesota noxious weed law. If there is a complaint on that and the county or the township or the city doesn't do it, then it rises to a county level. And the county typically in law had to name a noxious weed inspector on a county level, and they were responsible then ultimately for seeing to it that the law was carried out locally. The county's asked, and for good reason, I think we're making that change in here, that they not have to be required to specify someone as a noxious weed inspector. Some counties might only get two or three, five or six calls a year on this, because for the most part it's a local issue, and they're only called when there's problems with that local connection. So the counties have asked that they either appoint a noxious weed, or they may just appoint a person to be an overseer. That might be your county engineer, for example, or someone. They wouldn't officially be a county inspector, but would have the responsibility of that county to coordinate any complaints at the local level. And they would do that in coordination with the Department of Agriculture, which is where they will get their knowledge. The department, if you can see in here, is going to convene at least every 3 years a working group to update the noxious weed list and make sure that all the laws are updated and modern, and except for the first, they're going to do this within the first year, but then every 3 years after. And they will also keep website and other things with this information so that people, our citizens, our farmers, our growers, our complainers have a place to go when they have a complaint that will list the laws and the weeds and the other things, so the state will maintain that also. But beyond that, there's a lot of other, recodification and other things set up. One of the main reasons it came to this committee, there's also an account set up in the RFA. So Rural Finance will now hold a noxious weed account that will be designated for collecting monies that may come in for the noxious weed program. We don't have a place for those monies to go now as we collect them. They can be from private resources, but most likely they come from federal government or entities, USDA, entities like that. So when we capture those dollars, we now have a dedicated fund that we're setting up in this bill in the RFA to handle them. So I'm going to quit there. I'd ask Testifier if he's got anything to add. I'm sure I screwed something up. And if there's other important issues in here that he'd briefly want to talk about.
All right. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed, please.
My name is Steve Kaplan. I am a senior conservation scientist with the Nature Conservancy, but also a member of the Noxious Weed Task Force, that was charged with coming up with language to modify the noxious weed law. That task force included 12 different members, including such groups as the Minnesota Nursery and Landscape Association, the University of Minnesota, the Farm Bureau, the Farmers Union Association of Townships, Minnesota Department of Transportation, the DNR, the Association of County Agricultural Inspectors, the Association of Minnesota Counties, were all participants in this process to come up with the recommendations that you see before you. We reached near unanimous agreement on all issues except the point of the responsibilities of the county agricultural inspector or designee, and that is frankly still being discussed as we work out some final agreements. But as Representative Junkie has did so well, he covered most everything that I think is key in this bill. I think it's a process that will work much better in the form that we're talking about here. And I think with that, I would stand for questions. And I also have with me other members of the task force that are probably much more involved in this than I am, and I think between us, we'll try to answer the questions you might have. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Any questions from the committee? Representative Magnus.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've got a question pertaining to subdivision 12 on line 422 through 426 of the bill. And my question deals with the language added, adding soil, gravel, and other material. Now, is this going to get us into trouble with some of our contractors down the road that are building roads and hauling gravel around and that sort of thing? How is this going to work? How are they going to do this,
Mr. Chaplin?
Mr. Chair and Representative Magnus, the intent of this provision was to provide a mechanism so that these other soil, gravel, and other materials could be certified as noxious weed. There was some demand for those sorts of materials. Our intent wasn't to require certification of a broad range of materials. It was to provide a mechanism of how these materials could be certified.
So, Mr. Chair and Representative Magnus, if you're a nursery and you need for your landscaping noxious weed-free material, this is a way to certify that that's the case. So you come and ask for it, not the contractor would ask. The state wouldn't be requiring it to be certified.
Representative Magnus?
So that's my concern, that all of a sudden I'll get calls from these folks saying, "What in the world did you do?" I can't do anything unless somebody comes out here and tells me this doesn't have any weeds in it. How are they going to prove that?
Right.
So that makes some sense then.
Okay. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. At least in my area, the usual noxious weed that is called in is thistle. And by the time somebody makes the complaint and then you send out the notice to the landowner, give him 5 or 10 days to comply with the violation, he may file an appeal. And by that time, the thistle will go into seed. Anything can be done to speed up the process to make it so that we can get those weeds out before they go to seed.
Mr. Chaplin.
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, if I could, I'd like to ask Greg Pence to address that issue. He is the county agricultural inspector and a member of the task force, and I think could do a much better job answering the question than I could.
Okay.
And I would add also that the committee, as he's coming up, should look at section, look at lines 314 to 19. The other unique thing this bill does is allow our weed control agents to enter into cooperative agreements with landowners. Typical in our area, Representative Anderson, where we're at too, is a lot of set-aside ground, CRP, CREP, RIM, that tends to be overgrown, and our own government, whether it's state or federal, is not taking care of it. And so rather than allow that 5 to 10 day, what we've actually asked for there is to have them enter into an agreement with the state or the feds to control those weeds and put a plan together to control them over a three-year period. Because, again, a lot of times, I know, I'm sure you're going to tell me as a weed inspector, it's hard to get someone out there with the Roundup in 10 days. But if we do a three-year control plan, especially in some of these larger acreages, I think we're going to be money ahead. But specifically to your question, here's the inspector.
Please state your name for the record and begin.
My name is Greg Fent, and I am a county agricultural inspector, and I was a member of the task force. To answer your question, that can be a problem. There's not a lot of good ways to shorten it up. The length of time has been set over a number of years through the court. The appeal process was a court mandated back in, I believe, in the early to mid-90s, and that process does add 4 or 5 additional days. The advantage with, or maybe a disadvantage in the case of Canada thistle, is that the seed, even though you start to see it fly, it all doesn't become viable right away. So even after the 10 days and it starts to float around, if you knock it down, at least you keep it on that current site instead of letting it blow all over.
Yeah. Representative Anderson, a follow-up? All right, Representative Magna.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know it in here that you're asking the department to do quite a few things. Is there any funding in here, additional funding for the department, or are they, what are we estimating this is going to cost them?
Representative Johnson.
I don't know. I haven't seen a fiscal note on this. So, and the department hasn't come to me and told me to put a line item in yet, but they probably will tomorrow now.
Yeah.
Since you mentioned it, but we'll see. But I, you know, the main project is every 3 years to get that group together and facilitate a meeting to update the noxious weed list. And you know, they already have some oversight to this. I mean, we're not definitely adding a whole new realm to them. They do oversee a lot of this now, but we are specifying in more detail some of the things we'd like them to do in addition to what they're probably doing now.
Representative Magnus?
I do have the department here, too.
Mr. Friesel will probably answer me.
Mr. Friesel, please.
Now, don't ask for any money just because...
I think they're going to get money back.
Let's get John.
Easier. So we're going to reduce their budget. No.
Mr. Friesel, please. State your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, my name is Pierre Friesel. I'm a director of the Plant Protection Division, Minnesota Department of Agriculture, and I'm glad Representative Junkie gave me that opening to plead for money. So, now, in all seriousness, we do already provide some... resources and staff to support both noxious weeds and invasive species. It's not a great deal of time. We lost most of our funding during the last budget shortfall of several years ago. So I'm guessing we probably put about a quarter of an FTE already dedicated towards noxious weeds. And there are a number of additional responsibilities with this bill for the commission. We think they're important responsibilities. And we would be able to be okay with reprioritizing maybe some of our invasive species staff to take on some of these additional duties. We don't have a huge amount of ability, but I think we can afford some of that.
Representative Magnus.
Okay, well, that I think that's something we'll visit about as we move down the road here on this. I'm finished.
All right, thank you. Any other testifiers? Anybody else would like to testify? See one. Moving forward. Please state your name for the record and
thank you,
proceed.
Mr. Chair. My name is Sandy Nair, and I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Newspaper Association, which is a trade association of 100% of the 375 newspapers in the state. And this is a very minor point in this bill, and I do apologize to Representative Junkie for not having caught it a little bit earlier. There is one provision in this bill that takes the publication requirement for the noxious weed notice out of the newspapers and just puts it on the county website. And I am being told by the rural newspapers that this is a very important publication and that they think it belongs in the newspaper. Minnesota law does require when newspapers print legal notices that they have to, at no additional cost, put it on the newspaper website also. So it is already on the internet, and that seems to be where most people go for this. I did talk to House Research earlier today, and I think they had prepared an amendment that Representative Magnus had in his packet, but of course this is a Representative Junkie's bill, and I do appreciate his consideration. I did talk with other members of the task force, and it did not appear as if it was a major issue to anybody except, of course, my friends at the Association of Minnesota County. So.
Members, we are referring to line 88.1, right?
Yeah. Which line?
Page 8. Line 1.
I think the amendment would need to be in two places. On page 6, line 30, you would still delete the new language and reinstate the current language. And then page, I think it's the A5 amendment. And then page 31 and 32, you just reinstate current language. Page 8, line 1, you delete the new language.
Okay, we have an amendment being passed out right now. Representative Junkie, do you have any comments or questions?
The only question I have, and I can't answer it since it's a new, whatever the committee wants to do, but how often are these published, and what kind of costs are we talking about for the counties? I mean, I'm sure that's part of the discussion. I don't even know how often you publish. I mean, I read my paper, and I actually read the legal publications, and I can't recall seeing a noxious weed publication jump out at me. So I'm just wondering, you know, is it in the county newspaper of record, like our other public notices, and how often are they published? What's the requirements here? I really don't know.
Mr. Chair,
I
was told by members of the task force who work for the county that this is a once a year publication. This is not real often. It's once a year, and I think one of them told me that their county spent $8 for this publication. Somebody else said it was a $40 publication. I don't think it's a lot of money. Again, it is a fairly minor
point. I guess I'd like more information on specifically what them just do. What are we publishing? The names of the bad guys, or the names of the weeds, or the names of the... What are we doing?
Yeah, Representative Magnus.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it's a general practice in our area, at least the townships, each year in the spring, print a notice in the papers. Each township does, saying control your noxious weeds or else. Basically, we'll do that. Well, I don't know if this replaces that, and I don't know how detailed this is going to be, but once a year they come out with this saying, better control your noxious weeds or else.
What do you put in the paper every year?
I think they do it to protect themselves. If they come out and spray my weeds, they can send me a bill for it later.
Mr. Spence?
Under the current law, the responsibility is at the county, and it must be published on or before May 15th. What is published, there is a recommendation, legal notice that the Department of Ag has produced several years ago, and that's generally what most counties publish. And it just is your obligation under the law, list of noxious weeds. There's some information, a couple sentences about the appeals process, and the name of who to call.
We have a question, Representative Szymanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I'm sorry. Hold on. Representative Magnus had a follow-up. I'm sorry. Representative Magnus.
Just a follow-up, Mr. Chairman. I'm not sure. I think my county's a website, but I'm not sure if they do. And, you know, I don't know how many other people in the counties know about. We did get electricity there recently. And we do have internet access now. But I can't tell you, you know, people have, I don't know how many people use it, if they even have them. I'm sure they have them, but I don't know how organized they are and qualified they are. So I'm just trying to protect people is all I'm trying to do.
Okay. Representative Szymanski?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I would, follow up on Representative Magnus's comments that, it does appear in the local newspapers and it's usually at the initiative of the township, but on behalf of the numerous farmers and landowners who do not check the county website for noxious weed control notices, I would highly recommend that we maintain the newspaper publication of those noxious weed notices.
So, Mr. Chair, I'd have a question to either staff or someone in the room that knows. Is it then the city and the township that's paying the publication, not the county? So it's not a county issue.
Mr. Sullivan, would you like to answer that?
The current law requires publishing, and the local unit is the weed inspecting unit of record. So are they the ones publishing that?
Mr. Sullivan.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I don't believe there'd be a new responsibility for the local unit of government. On page 6, line 30, when the publication requirement is removed, it would require the county instead to provide information on, I guess that would be on the county's website. So I think the requirement to provide a general notice remains, but now it's in the form of provide information.
Yeah, rather it's than the public. Duty of the county ag inspectors. It says on 612 to 613, and then it lists all their duties and to publish as the county. So you're right.
Okay. I see we have somebody else. One.
Now we have the counties.
Please state your name for the record and begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Ryan O'Connor from the Association of Minnesota Counties, and I'd just like to go on record and say that we obviously would support the increased flexibility under the current law or under the current bill as it is without the amendment. It doesn't mean the counties are precluded from publishing in a newspaper, and if the elected officials in a particular area felt that they didn't have a website that was up to par to be using it as their information dissemination device, we would encourage those elected officials to make sure their information gets to their constituents in the best way possible, which could be the newspaper. But in other areas where websites are well-developed, we would like that opportunity and flexibility to use the website as a vehicle of information for the county. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you. Representative Doty has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not a question, really, a statement in support of this amendment. My county has a very good website, but my county's average age for a farmer is like 57, 58, and you know, there's a lot of 20 and 30 year olds in there, so there's a lot of my folks that don't look at that good county website. So I think this amendment is probably a good idea.
Representative Walty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, I'm just wondering, I know in my county the landowners all receive from either the NRCS or the Soil Water Conservation District a newsletter that comes out, and I'm wondering, do you know if that's common practice throughout the state? Because if it is, then you'd have another means to put ad, or not an ad, but print this in the newsletter that comes out to landowners.
That's fine.
Mr. Chair, Representative Welty, I'm sorry, I do not know off the top of my head. And a quick scan back here didn't indicate that anyone else could provide that answer for you either.
Okay. Representative Welty, follow-up?
So I'm just wondering if, Mr. Chair and members, I'm just wondering if there's a effective way to get the message out to all of our landowners. I know that with existing resources that we have, because there are many people that receive papers in my district and there are many people who do not, and it depends on which paper you contract with. If you're contracting with a county paper or if you're contracting with the township, I'm trying to figure out who's doing this and if there's overlap or not. If you can answer that, I'd appreciate any direction.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative Welty, I think the dilemma of trying to figure out the one-size-fits-all approach really highlights the flexibility that the bill without the amendment would allow for counties with newsletters. That would be an obvious good vehicle to publish that notice as well on their own terms. And, you know, when they're putting together a county newsletter, it's in the best interest of the county to publish the information that's important to their members. So I would think that would be a good spot for it, regardless of a mandate or not. I don't think it necessarily requires a mandate for a county to want to do that. So I agree with you that there is not one size that fits all for every publication, but I do think that it's in county's best interest to provide their citizens with the information, and I think they would do so.
Representative Walty?
And Mr. Chair?
Representative Junkie.
It looks like there's some positive response from committee members to this amendment. I would suggest maybe just putting it on for now, and then the counties and the weed inspection group get together and work with Representative Magnus and see if there's any other options for flexibility, because we've got a couple days, not long, but this will be in the omnibus bill next week. So we do have a day or two here to review this and see if there's another option. Like Representative Welty said, is there a FSA publication or other things that go out, and can we give them the flexibility to put a notice in some of those landowner publications that might be little or no cost, frankly, to be involved there?
Okay. Representative Magnus moves the A5 amendment. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Junkie?
That's all I got, members. This will be laid over, hopefully, for possible inclusion, and moving ahead, good government all the time.
All right. Representative Junkie renews his motion to have House File 1367 be laid over for possible inclusion as amended. Any other
Again, just a notice to members, if you have, I know I've got some appointments with some members, but if you have anything you want in the omnibus bill that's being written this week, now's the time to chirp up and talk to me or AJ on it, and we'll try and get it in there.
All right. Meeting adjourned.